welcome you today, this afternoon, to our panel on performance and activism, alternative academic strategies. This panel was organized by Joni Jones, or Omi, from the University of Texas in Austin here. And the purpose of the panel is to explore how the academy can be used to introduce strategies for social change. Our first speaker today is Dr. Soyini Henderson. Madison, and her work focuses on performance ethnography and the intersections between gender and critical race theory. She's recently returning from a Rockefeller Foundation fellowship in Bellagio, Italy, where she's writing her current project focusing on staging and performing local debates surrounding human rights and traditional religious practices. I'd like you to join me in welcoming Dr. Soyini Madison.
Begins with critical performance ethnography. It means traveling to other locations, and in my case, the location is Ghana, West Africa. It means putting in deep embodied time there to learn and do what needs to be learned and done in that ethnographic space. Ethnographic work shows me that the world is very, very small. And when people say to me, why go so far away to do activist work because charity really begins at home, I say to them, the planet is my home. Martin Luther King Jr. reminded us that when there is human suffering anywhere, far or near, we are all suffering everywhere. Critical performance ethnography is the work that inspires me. It is necessarily what Mandy Schutzman calls ambulant, borrowing from Susan Foster's discussion of ambulatory scholarship. The root ambi means to wander, to go or cause to go from one place to another, to arrive and to depart, to take or cause to take action. Ambulatory, for Schutzman and Foster, is the language of the body, moving in space and time, and how the body refigures, changes, and transforms that space. I traveled to Ghana, West Africa, to work with Ghanaian human rights activists. I am interested in their day-to-day lives, their interventionist tactics, and the sacrifices they make for human rights and for the development in their own country. I am interested in local activism and how this activism sustains itself under neoliberal policies and the negative forces of poverty, free trade, and corporate globalization. On the outside, I appear to some more as a social scientist, more concerned with issues of political economy, policy formation, structural adjustments, and governance than I do as an artist performer. But political theater teaches us that you cannot separate the metaphor from its material contingencies and economic relations. We understand, as Dwight Conkergood said, that symbols are made through structures of power, and structures of power are made through symbols. I come to know what I know in the social world, political economy, culture, and human rights, by interpreting it all through a performance lens, a language and logic of performance. I encounter social scientific realities, or what I prefer to call the embodied experience of fieldwork, through a theater of the oppressed and performance paradigm. It is out of ambulant necessity that ethnographic data, understood through this logic of performance, must continue on in its movements and wanderings. It cannot rest or remain still in any theory or philosophy, not even performance theory. After analysis, the ethnographic project must move. It must move on to other sites and adventures so as to now inhabit other bodies. What is analyzed in the social world through theories of performance will both depart and enter. It will travel from the site of its tents of origins, Ghana, West Africa, so that it may wander and arrive in another site, a University of North Carolina classroom, where this ethnographic social world will be further embodied by a community of performers on a public stage. What I want to do now is show you some of the slides of the performance called Water Rights that we made in the spring of 2006. Okay. Can I do this? I'm trying to do it. Okay, yay. All right, so what you're seeing here are just a series of slides from the show, and I'll be talking about that in the introduction, and then later on you'll see slides from my actual field work. Okay. On March 2nd through March 6th of 2006, a group of students and I opened Water Rights, R-I-T-E-S, a performance based on my ethnographic field work in Ghana, West Africa, on water and privatization. We played to an overflowing crowd and ended up having to turn people away the last night of the show. Through the production of Water Rights, we hoped, in Jill Dolan's words, to use performance to incite people to profound responses that shape their consciousness of themselves in the world, unquote. The purpose. I employed performance as a pedagogical tool to incite both audience and performers. In making a performance, I am deliberately making a community energized and hopefully transformed by a specific polemic and by the process of learning and embodying why that polemic matters. Relationships are formed in the very formation of the artistic product. In my work, I am as much, perhaps more, concerned by the process of community and relationship building as I am with the product witnessed before the audience. The process. First, the performers kept a journal and recorded, from beginning to end, their impressions, insights, knowledges, and responses around the experience of developing this show. Second, we employed evocative collaboration as they read a series of materials on water democracy and privatization, as they viewed selected video documentaries on corporate globalization and international resistance movements against privatization. At our first rehearsal, I asked them questions about their first memory of water, and they were to respond by recounting through story or poetry a graphic performative memory. They were then to share their memories and create stage pictures and movements. Third, I, in turn, shared with them memories from my field journal and stories from Ghana as we sat in a circle under candlelight thinking and talking quietly about water. Fourth, I invited them to my home and cooked for them as we watched interview footage from my field work and continued deeper levels of engagement, both politically and personally, with water. Fifth, at the beginning of rehearsal, we shared warm-up exercises to bring our bodies and voices together to comfort, relax, trust, and mark the sacred transition from the day-to-day busyness into the sacredness of the rehearsal space. All in all, we talked together, meditated together, moved together, wrote together, ate together, and reimagined the politics of water together. From the beginning of rehearsal to the end, we came together, took time out, and sat and asked ourselves, what are we doing? What does this mean? Why is it important? The script. The script evolved into a montage of writings from journal entries, poems, monologues, and stories the performers created as they embodied what they learned about water. The script also included my ethnographic notes and reflections. What I will do today is share a few moments from the production. Is this looping around again and again?
Yeah.
Okay, you can stop it. I'm going to show you sections and move between the fieldwork, the show, and rehearsal. The show was formed in three parts. Part one was entitled Water Stories. It captured our first memories of water and the spirit of water as a precious phenomenon, that is, its beauty and wonder, its power as a natural force, both devastating and destructive, while simultaneously creating and sustaining life. Part two was entitled Water Business, and it politicized water as a contested and volatile issue among water activists and within international financial institutions. This part was performed through comic satire, parody, and spoken word. Part three, entitled Water Wars, enacted global struggles and resistance through local stories across specific countries, Bolivia, Haiti, India, Tanzania, and Ghana. Exemplified here were representational dramatizations or scenes of historical moments that constituted water wars in those countries. The performance concluded with a poetic question and assertion about activism, truth, and what it means to perform other stories from other lands and other struggles. Now I will share moments from the show Water Whites while weaving those moments between my fieldwork in Ghana and rehearsals on the campus of Chapel Hill. The rehearsal. January 17, 2006, Tuesday evening. This is from my journal that night. Before I can teach about the politics of water, I must teach about the spirit of water. Before there is politics, I really believe there is a soul. We are all water, and water is all of us. Water is living, changing, and responsive. To believe this is the purpose of rehearsal two. There are 18 of us. We are all sitting together on the floor in a large circle. The room is dark. On the floor in front of each of us is a candle. The only light in the room is a flame from each of our candles. I ask the performers to breathe deeply and look into the flame. I say to them, feel the quiet in the room and focus on the flame. Look into the light of the flame and how it moves against the darkness. I stop speaking and the room is quiet. We enjoy the quiet and the flame and a few more seconds. I look around and the students are focused, making the transition from the noisiness and busyness of their daily self into this temporality of a water rites rehearsal. I break the silence. I say to them, please look into the flame. Be still and quiet. Now close your eyes. Two of my graduate assistants, Anissa Clark and Elizabeth Nelson, begin reading passages from Masura Umoto's The Hidden Message of Water. I then ask them to open their eyes and share a word or a phrase that impressed them, that stuck with them from the reading, and that they will want to remember. When all have spoken, I conclude rehearsal by asking them to read from their journal assignment on memory and their first discovery or recognition of water. Now moving to the performance. And a digital image is displayed on two large screens. A video recording made by my daughter, Turquoise Madison Dyson, entitled Water Rites, opens the show. Thank you.
Changes, we change. When there is no water, when it turns dry, when its clarity is stolen, every cell in our bodies will cry or die for water.
Back to the rehearsal. I'm reading from my journal notes. I am the most vulnerable ever as a teacher when I read to my students from my field notes. I read now and they listen. How they are listening at this moment and what they feel and what they think, I simply cannot gauge it all. I continue reading, shaking and scared, trying to gather the confidence that however they are receiving what I read at this moment, it is my experience, and it is true and deeply dear to me, and above all, necessary for them to know. A day at the market. I was standing at the Trotro stop trying to get a bus back home. I'm in Ghana, Accra, right in the middle of the city. It was so hot that day, I could hardly breathe, and nothing could quench the thirst. Every Trotro that passed was filled with people packed, crushed inside, trying to get where they were needed to go. A stream of dilapidated old vans full of exhaust fumes, sweaty bodies, overbearing heat and smells. Everything felt so crowded and so dirty that day. I was hot and tired and missing my home in the U.S., and feeling very much like the ugly American. As I waited, hoping a Trotro would come so I could squeeze into one empty seat and get back to the quiet and solitude of my flat at Lagon, I looked down the road a bit. I saw a woman sitting over a bucket of soapy water. There was a child at her feet. She undressed the child and then placed the baby in the bucket of water. She was bathing the child in the public marketplace. Quiet and solitude for her are a different reality than they are for me. I was transfixed by what was more than just a woman bathing a child outside in a hot, crowded market, but how the ordinary, how the day-to-day is so strong and impeccably resilient against the facts of its own reality. As I watched the woman and child, suddenly an old man, appearing to be mad, his hair matted, half-dressed with very dirty clothes, walked up to the woman. Without the least concern, she simply brushed him away with a wave of her hand and continued to bathe the child. The man, undeterred, filthy and dirty, stumbled toward the bucket and began taking off his clothes as he attempted to step into the soapy water with the baby. Immediately, two young men standing next to me at the Trotro stop quickly walked over to the old man and with sincere gentleness and gracious respect helped the man put his clothes on and then guided him back down the road. The woman paying no mind to the old man, no mind to anyone or anything else around her, kept her willful attention on her child and their ritual. For much of the global South, specifically Africa, dirt is a fact and a symbol. Mary Douglas said it first. Dirty people, having dirty children, with dirty faces, wearing dirty clothes. Dwight Conkergood stated, quote, labeling someone or something dirty is a way of controlling perceived anomalies, incongruities, contradictions, ambiguities, all that does not fit into our category and therefore threatens cherished principles. Dirt, then, functions as the mediating term between difference and danger. We know that dirt is to be gotten rid of, but do we tend to forget that dirt will dwell where water is inaccessible? Nor do we remember that when sanitation systems are impaired or non-existent, dirt embraces disease. The other bodies, the loathsome bodies, the dirty bodies, the disfigured bodies, the sick body, the body that smells of refuge, the body that oozes, excretes, and cannot shelter its waste, the bodies grotesquely out of place, are the bodies that wrenching poverty will breed in its abominable lack. Disgust encircles these bodies with visceral loathing and fear. Fear of nearness and the threat of contamination. Loathing for the failure of these bodies to keep themselves out of sight. Dirt is a factor of economic and political conditions, but as a tactical deflection, it is generally cast as a moral flaw. But in this small moment, on a hot day in a crowded African market, a woman bathes her child, a water right, resistant and real. Back to the performance. The next performance segment focuses on a donkey cart seller at a pond in a town called Savalugu, located in northern Ghana. The purpose of this segment was to personalize young men who sell water by situating them as subjects within their own story and individual history. This donkey cart seller, I'm going to show you his picture. This donkey cart seller is a composite character named Ibrahim, who gives us a glimpse of what it means to sell water from the back of a donkey. I wrote the Ibrahim monologue from information and experiences gathered in the field over the years pertaining to donkey cart sellers, guinea worm, and how families manage through the perils of water access. It was intended to more fully narrate and imagine the inner lives of those who sell water at the backs of donkeys and the consequences of their labor. Projected on two large screens are four sequential images from photographs I took that day at the pond of a donkey cart seller. He is a boy about the age of 14. In various images, he stands with his donkey. Each image fades into the next as the following monologue is performed. The character Ibrahim stands on a platform just below the screen. His shadow is cast over half the screen. These images will continue to loop. But during the show, the character Ibrahim spoke through the narrative voice of this young man that you see. This segment is part of a larger segment. When I was in Savalugu, I was there at the pond and was taking these pictures and also doing videotapes. And you can see the water is mud brown. This is the water people were fetching from the pond because their standpipes were locked that day. My name is Ibrahim. I'm from Savalugu. I'm 14 years old and I sell water. I am what the people call a donkey cart water seller. I go down to the pond every day with my donkey and I fetch water. My younger brother goes with me. We travel about 5 miles every day back and forth to the pond. We sell water to the people here. There are other donkey cart water sellers, but we are the best. Some of the old people and the sick people can't carry the water or walk to fetch it. And the people who take care of them are too busy. The pond is too far. Sometimes the pond will dry up and we have to search for water. My brothers and me are very, very happy because we have our donkey. We are blessed to have this donkey. We get up in the morning before the sun and we get a rope and we tie the rope to the many, many buckets around the donkey's back. Then we start our first walk to the pond. Me, my brother, and the donkey get inside the pond where the water is full and plenty. My brother fills up the bowls and pours water in the buckets that we have fastened to the donkey's back. I hold the donkey very, very carefully so the donkey won't slide and fall down and spill the water back into the pond. The water is heavy. My brother pours and pours, and I hold on. When the buckets are filled, and my little brother's back is tired, we leave the pond. We start the journey with our donkey to sell water to the people who need it. When the water is sold, we go back to the pond, and we start all over again. I hold on to the donkey, and my brother fills up the buckets. We fetch water from the pond 6 times a day. My mother worries that my brother and me will get the guinea worm from the water. Many people around here have gotten guinea worm from the water. But we have not gotten any guinea worm, not yet, not me and my brother. My mother has guinea worm and my little sister. My little sister was sick for a long, long time. You are very blessed when you don't get guinea worm because you can keep working and fetching water and making money to live. They pulled the worm out of my little sister's leg, and in a few days she felt better. Oh, it was a big, long guinea worm. It looked longer and bigger than my little sister's leg. My mother said she could not fetch water anymore, so it's just my brother and me. If I get guinea worm, I will worry. Who will hold the donkey? My mother told me that when she was a young girl, they had plenty, plenty water. Water flowed from the pipes every day. They bathed and washed and drank, never got sick. No tired back, no guinea worm, no worry. When my mother was a young girl, fresh water flowed from the pipes. Not anymore. This is the last part. The final poem in the performance. The very last scene in the performance crystallized in poetic form the purpose of water rights, the work of water justice, ethnographic inquiry, water as a human right, and where we as a cast and as an ethnographer director hope to go with and beyond the performance. Two narrators come downstage, moving in a wave-like pattern, coming together. I'm sorry. Just can't get this technology. The cast begins entering on the last 6 lines of the poetic dialogue and take their positions on the platforms upstage. Images of Ghana are projected on the 2 large screens that cover the stage. These images are being shown on stage while the two narrators are speaking this last poetic monologue. Truth is elusive, but it demands our attention. It doesn't stay in one place or breathe inside one story. But it can. We've got to find those one places and those one stories. We've got to search. Truth demands our attention in the multitudes of its yearnings. We've got to fight for it. We are not alone. We can see and listen deeply, can we? Past the obtuse blindness of appearances and the paralyzing silence of too much noise. Deep past the lies reborn again and again by the greedy and the lazy. We will search for truth in the multitudes of the one story. The one story that is always here and there and in the everywhere details of life lived on the hard-edged blade of truth's teeth. It will hurt, it always does, because truth's blade cuts deep, deep at the skin and bone of what it implies, the implication. Yes, the implication that breaks your heart and demands the search for more truth, more truth, more. Do we feel our hearts breaking from the teeth? Sometimes. But more than breaking, we feel our heart swelling as if it is about to burst open into flames. Burst from what? bursts from the fear and hope of finding the right question to spark the right story that will unleash an avalanche of truths. Bursting from the fear and hope of how we will carry these stories back so they will not soften the teeth of truth or dull its blade. We are bursting from how we will listen and wrap words around the stories that we must carry back, back home, back here, back everywhere. The words we wrap around truth's teeth will fly past us and carry themselves beyond our reach. We make retold stories. Every retold story becomes a traveling story, retold far beyond the presence of our own body. Retold for truth's sake, to harden the teeth and sharpen the blade? Yes, our hearts are bursting and not breaking from the weight of the search, the weight of the question, the implication, but most of all, from the weight of carrying these truths truly. Yes, beyond our reaches and beyond the starting point of the one true story. What gives us the right to search for true stories? How can we hang words upon them? We are not of this place. This is not our home. We live in the richest country in the world. That is a fact. What should we do about it? Use it like a blade on fire against its own flame. For truth's sake? Yes. For the sake of hearts on the verge of exploding. Yes. For the sake of hearts on the verge of exploding. Thank you.